On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Hockenberry, and this is On Point. So Congress makes the laws, right? The courts interpret the laws. Are you with me here? And the president enforces the laws. It's the three-part supposedly balanced system of government that lies at the heart of our Constitution. The power of Congress and the president have ebbed and flowed throughout history, but are we at a turning point now? President Bush claims vast wartime powers and an apparent authority to pick and choose which laws to enforce and how. Is there any precedent for this? Is Congress allowing it to happen? The courts have disputed the Bush doctrine on presidential power, but will that change the president's course? This hour on Point, balance of power. Are the wheels coming off the constitutional wagon? Joining me now in the studio for the whole hour, I'm happy to say, is Professor Lawrence Tribe, professor at Harvard Law School and one of America's leading constitutional law scholars. Professor Tribe, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
How would you characterize, we certainly hear pieces of it in the news, signing statements, NSA surveillance, warrantless wiretaps, the Guantanamo detainees, treatment of wartime prisoners, presidential discretion on all of these sorts of matters. How would you characterize broadly what's going on, and do you think it has lasting constitutional implications?
I think what's going on broadly is that we have an administration that treats constitutional limits on the president's power as something between irrelevant and a nuisance, but simply not effective, not binding when it comes to what the president unilaterally or with congressional acquiescence deems a war, even a metaphorical war on something like terror, a technique rather than an organized entity. A war that may go on forever. Now, the claim is not literally that he's a monarch. The president always responds, of course I'll obey the law. But the trick is his idea of the law is fundamentally self-serving. It is when I, the president of the United States, decide that the nation's security requires that certain steps be taken in pursuing this amorphous and protean enemy of international global terrorism, anything that Congress tries to do to restrict me, if it tells me whom I may or may not treat in certain inhumane ways, if it tries to tell me whom I may or may not eavesdrop upon, anything of that kind is unconstitutional. Now, of course, if that's what the law is, then for all practical purposes, the president is not bound by law. And this administration seems determined, even though the number of instances on which it actually trespasses on constitutional rights may actually be limited, it's determined to lay down a marker for the future that will leave the legacy of a virtually unfettered executive branch rather than a system of checks and balances.
It's an alarming idea that the president is unilaterally taking power for himself and the executive in a way that will have lasting constitutional implications and that you say is against the law, is basically outside of your understanding of the rule of law. Yet the president, in justifying his actions, culls from several sources. One in particular is the Commander-in-Chief Clause in Article 2, which I would love for you to describe how you make that argument and or what your understanding of that argument is. And then the precedent that has existed down through history, which I was surprised to learn about in preparing for this show, of presidents being able to say, you know, this law, I don't think it's constitutional. I think I don't like it. And that presidents have a certain amount of discretion there. Those seem to be the two main sources of the president right now.
The commander-in-chief power is certainly an important power of the president. It means that when the military is engaged in either a declared war or a lawful military activity, the president has the ultimate authority to direct the strategy and the tactics that are to be used and can't be micromanaged by other branches. But at the same time, it has never before meant that the other branches, and in particular the legislative branch, cannot lay down in broad outline the rules and regulations that must be obeyed by the president. The Constitution is very clear in saying that Congress has the power to take all steps necessary and proper to regulate the executive in the execution of their of his various powers, including the commander-in-chief power. But this president basically says being commander-in-chief of the military almost makes me commander-in-chief of the country, something that the court has repeatedly rejected.
It's as though he's put Congress in the chain of command, and you say that's been explicitly rejected by the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court, when President Truman, during the Korean War, tried to nationalize the steel industry to prevent an interruption in the flow of equipment to our troops, the Supreme Court repudiated what the president did, saying that without congressional authorization, and even more clearly in the face of some explicit or implied congressional prohibition, the president simply cannot take any such major policy initiative. Justice Jackson wrote a famous concurring opinion. Justice Jackson, formerly the Attorney General and the Chief Prosecutor at Nuremberg, wrote a famous concurring opinion saying that being the commander-in-chief of the military does not make the president commander-in-chief of the country. It's true that on occasion, when the country was in profound peril, when its very existence was at stake, as when President Lincoln during the Civil War to protect the troops of the Union as they passed through areas where they otherwise would have been essentially waylaid and hijacked, suspended the writ of habeas corpus. But he did it understanding that it would ultimately be up to Congress either to ratify or to not ratify his action. This president basically doesn't want to give Congress the time of day, although when the Supreme Court of the United States tells him that he cannot have his own little system of military trials in violation of the Geneva Conventions, at least without Congress giving him a clear green light, pretends as though he's always wanted to get Congress in on the act anyway.
Well, the case that you refer to, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, about the Guantanamo Bay detainees and the president's alleged discretion, the court says no, by a 5-4 decision, you don't have that discretion because Congress explicitly said there were statutory oversights on detainees and that you can't simply say or ignore Congress's express intention
and
in the statute.
More even than statutory oversight, the most fundamental treaties in this area, all of the Geneva Conventions, have a common Article 3, which the Supreme Court reminded the president is not limited to ordinary combat against organized armies, and which provides a kind of baseline of protection. Senator McCain, in the compromise legislation that was passed, also tried to impose that kind of protection. And, of course, Congress could try to take the radical step of repealing the McCain Amendment and saying torture is fine, or repealing the nation's commitment to the Geneva Conventions. But I doubt that Congress would pay the political price of effectively leaving the community of nations. And unless it does that, the president has been basically told by the court that he must obey the law. But you asked also the question about presidential power selectively not to obey certain laws.
Well, hold on for that for a second.
Sure.
Because going back to this Hamdan decision, I mean, why does it seem to me, and maybe I'm a bit of a layman on this, that the reaction on the part of Congress, I mean, the president is the action agent here, basically taking this power and making these arguments. But it seems to me the critical player here is Congress, who seems, in response to the president saying Hamdan is erroneous, will get the congressional justification, and so delivers to Congress a bill saying, we want this authority, please, you know, take care of that for me, won't you? And Hastert and the gang get to work and start working on it. Why does it seem to me that Congress is utterly acquiescing here? Is that your impression?
Well, I hope that's premature, but we do have a fairly spineless Congress, partly, I suppose, for the obvious partisan reason that they're of the same party as the president. And it's rare but not unheard of that a Congress of the same party as the president will stand up for principle, but partly because the nature of the congressional and political process now and the nature of incumbency is such as to produce a bunch of guys who really are much more interested in preserving their little piece of turf than in standing up for principle in many instances. It's a good thing that Lindsey Graham happens to be there. He's a Republican with enormous credentials in terms of military expertise and a senator in the Republican Party. And Lindsey Graham, I think, is not quite so ready, nor are those who defer to him quite so ready to say that we just should rubber stamp the kinds of commissions the president established. He says that the Uniform Code of Military Justice should provide the starting point. And it just may be that the tendency of Congress to give the president exactly what he wants will be resisted this time. I hope so.
We're talking about presidential power, about the role of Congress and the courts in restraining a president. Here's what Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez had to say in response to Judge Anna Diggs Taylor's ruling last week that the administration's warrantless wiretapping program was illegal.
We're going to do everything that we can do in the courts to allow this program to continue because it is effective, has been effective in protecting America.
With me in the studio this hour is Lawrence Tribe, law professor at Harvard University and one of the country's top constitutional law scholars. And also joining us is Douglas Kmeck, professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University out in California. Professor Kmeck, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, John.
Let me ask a question to you that I've directed also to Professor Tribe that I didn't permit him to answer, but I'd love his view on it as well. What is the precedent, Professor Kmeck, for presidents basically deciding that they're going to resist enforcement or carrying out of a law because they believe it to be unconstitutional or constitutionally dubious?
Well, there's a long precedent on that, but I think the route I would trace is the Take Care Clause. There's a clause in the Constitution, John, that says that the president shall take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And while at first blush that may say, it seemed to say that the president is to be something in the nature of an automaton, just simply carrying out the jot and tittle of every provision written down in the code, one has to remember that in the word law, when you're taking care that the laws are faithfully executed, is the highest law, namely the Constitution. And it has been a longstanding view of many presidents, going back to Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, that when Congress passes a law that, especially a law that seems to encroach upon the powers of the executive, the kind of law that is not likely to be challenged in court easily because it would be difficult for individuals to assert proper standing or a case or controversy to bring the case, that the president has, by virtue of his oath, an obligation to defend the office, to defend the separation of powers, and in essence to defend, as I say, the higher law.
Do you see as, I will unfairly characterize Professor Tribe's characterization of the Bush administration, do you see something of a power grab here on the part of the Bush administration, a kind of slow-acting coup d'etat?
Professor Tribe and I have both written on this issue of signing statements and presidential power lately, and I think we have some agreement and disagreement. I don't think the president in good faith is seeking to place himself above the other branches. I do think he has been, on occasion, ill-served by two things. One, the frequency with which he has casually raised points of executive authority in the signing of legislation. But also, John, not just the frequency, but the unclarity, the level of generality at which he has raised these constitutional claims. I was in the Reagan administration and advised the president in the drafting of veto messages and signing statements during that period of time. And one of the things that was important to us then, and I think should be important now, is that the president raise his constitutional objections in the course of legislative discussion as a bill is pending, and if a constitutional problem is not addressed, that he be as specific as possible in raising the constitutional objection in the signing statement, both for purposes of giving direction to his subordinate executive officials in the executive branch, but also for continuing the conversation with the Congress and maintaining a level of visibility and accountability.
But it sounds like you're saying that the degree of generality and kind of open-endedness in the Bush tactics, or at least in the cases that we've seen so far, is new and possibly disturbing to you.
Well, I think it is new, and it is unhelpful to the constitutional process. And I think by and large, however, it's not a function of the president, although he must be accountable for all who work for him, but I think largely traceable to the people who are preparing these things in first draft and not fully explicating what it is their point is in any given circumstance.
Professor Tribe, describe to me the tactics that the Bush administration uses to claim, and again, I'm hearing this, you know, out in the lay world, it seems like when there is a critique of the president and a specific claim that a Bush administration action had no legal authority, Attorney General Gonzalez or members of the administration say, no, in fact, we had our lawyers look at it and they said it was just fine. Is that something that has typically happened as presidents justify themselves? Can you just rely on your own personal attorney to say, or local attorney or office attorney to say, hey, this is okay, go ahead?
Well, the president does have a very special attorney, the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, a position that my friend Professor Douglas Kmeck held with great distinction. And in the best of times, the person in that position gives the president honest and expert and professional advice and doesn't simply tell him what he wants to hear or what the vice president and the vice president's chief counsel want to hear. I'm not sure that this president has always been as well served, although, like Douglas Kmeck, I think the president has to be accountable. I don't think it's unusual that a president would have his attorney general say, and it's undoubtedly true, our lawyers have looked at it and they tell me it's fine. But it's the substance of that advice that's problematic in the case of this administration.
It's also a question of authority. I mean, do you think the Bush administration views the Office of Legal Counsel as a more important advisor than the Supreme Court in Ramdan v. Rumsfeld?
Well, I don't think that would be quite fair. I mean, the court did decide in Hamdan against Rumsfeld that the president was wrong. And the president says, well, I'll take their counsel. He makes it sound as though he needed that decision from this June in order to understand that, for example, Congress's authorization to go after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was not a virtual blank check to eavesdrop on Americans. And I there differ with the president. But the point really is a matter of degree and emphasis. But it's so great a matter of degree that it becomes a difference in kind. That is, I agree with Professor Kmeck that the frequency with which this president asserts executive prerogative and broadly states that Congress is without authority to impose various limits is a bit alarming, that the unclarity and breadth of those claims is alarming. But it's more than that. This hasn't become a real conversation with Congress. It's much more like the sound of one hand clapping. He doesn't veto, for example, a bill that he thinks is unconstitutional through and through because it ties his hands impermissibly. This president has vetoed only one bill in all of his time in office, the stem cell bill. Instead of using the veto the way it was originally intended to indicate that a completely unconstitutional measure in the president's view, and the president doesn't have to always have the same view as the Supreme Court, is one that he is not going to accept. This president instead signs the bill, tries to take credit for going along with Congress, and then issues a kind of blanket, vaporous signing statement that says, but of course I will make of this bill what, as the head of the unitary executive, I think I must, which is code for saying the bill is very nice, but it may not be worth the paper it's written on. And I think at that point, the objection that should be made is not, as the ABA seems to believe, that the president is making signing statements that we don't like. It's that the president's use of those signing statements down the road is something we should watch out for, because the president has no authority, and I think Douglas Kmeck would agree on this. The president doesn't have authority by expressing reservations about a bill to change its clear meaning or to alter the Constitution's meaning about the power in question.
Of course, the reality there is, will Congress actually say, no, you're wrong, and pass a law explicitly restricting the president? It's this ambiguity, it seems to me, that is an opportunity for the president. Professor Kmiak, do you believe that President Bush considers Congress not as some sort of constitutional adversary institution, but as part of what he views as a kind of uber executive, and that getting congressional authority is just one more bit of paperwork that he deals with in the bureaucracy all the time?
I think he has largely relied upon his own executive officers to give him advice, and I think he has, in his presidency, reacted in a way that one has seen presidents in the past react in wartime. I think there are problems with using the language of war on terror too liberally to describe the circumstance in which we are presently in. But immediately after 9/11, I think the president turned to his closest advisors, exercised the authority that Alexander Hamilton anticipated would be exercised in Federalist Paper number 70, that you would have a president who would act with energy and dispatch and to some degree secrecy. But I think, John, the difficulty I have is that as we get farther away from the events of 9/11, as we have to address the balance between confronting our external enemies and preserving civil liberties more carefully, it has been difficult, if you will, for some of the president's advisors to change his game plan from the one that he necessarily took and properly took immediately after the nation was attacked. I should say that, you know, Professor Tribe very nicely made reference before to Justice Jackson in the Youngstown case, the case that struck down Harry Truman's seizure of the steel mills. Justice Jackson pointed out in the beginning of that opinion that it would surprise many people on this subject of executive power how little useful and unambiguous authority there is to solve concrete problems. He even went so far as to say that much of the authority that exists in the law, the provisions in the Constitution and the cases construing it, were as enigmatic as the dreams Joseph was called upon to interpret for the Pharaoh. That's not an excuse. You still have to address the hard cases. But I think we do have to recognize that on issues such as the creation of military commissions, the concurrent jurisdiction of which was acknowledged to some degree in Title 10 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, on the terrorist surveillance issue, the argument that, in fact, the authorization for the use of military force might have been the wartime exception that the drafters of the FISA statute were thinking about. Professor Tribe and I had some disagreement on how to resolve those questions, but I think one can say that a good number of the lawyers who were advising the president were making a case for authority that was a plausible case and was not totally in disregard of the national interests or of Congress's role.
A case of streamlining authority as was envisioned by many constitutional scholars and judges who have noted the difficulty of acting quickly in our constitutional system. I'm talking with Douglas Kmiak, professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University, and Lawrence Tribe, professor of constitutional law at Harvard University, here in the studio. Clay is from Norwich, Connecticut. Clay, you're on the air.
I just wanted to comment that I'm absolutely in agreement with the decision of the courts to go against Bush's decision for his warrantless wiretap. If anyone paid any attention to history as we were all growing up, anyone has to notice the parallels here for seizure of power by a dictator. I don't believe that's Bush's intention, but the parallels to me are frightening, and that's the whole reason we have the checks and balances system. If you actually look at how dictators throughout history have rallied people behind a common cause, all the while silently removing their rights and then spying on them, which is exactly what this warrantless wiretap does, it's just, to me, it's scary, absolutely frightening.
Thank you, Clay. Do you believe the Bush administration is laying a kind of legal infrastructure for some future dictator in these sorts of decisions?
Well, it's important, I suppose, not to sound alarmist about all of this. And I think you'll notice that both Doug Mech and I sound calm. But deep down, I think I do, I have to confess, harbor more fear than some people do.
Deep down, Larry?
Deep down.
Deep? Is it really deep? Or
yeah,
is it a little closer
yes.
to the surface? Okay, good.
In the sense that I do think that it's very easy to exaggerate the degree to which we are about to plunge into the abyss. We do have a Supreme Court, even a conservative court, that reminds the president that he does not have a blank check. We have a court that very recently told the president that what he was doing in Guantanamo was profoundly lawless. And I believe that even a more conservative court is going to draw the line in a way that no court would have done in a genuine dictatorship. But that said, it seems to me that the danger of moving by small steps in the face of mounting fears, and particularly exacerbated by whatever future attack might occur that may be even worse than 9/11, the danger of moving toward something which may not deserve the name dictatorship but will not resemble the America that I am proud to have grown up in is a very real one, and we ought to be somewhat alarmed about that danger.
Professor Kremiak?
Well, my sense is that I would not be greatly alarmed because I don't believe the president is seeking to aggrandize his power just for the sake of power. I think he is, as I say, making good faith judgments on these questions, judgments that sometimes I disagree with, but nevertheless judgments that are defensible with legal argument, and that he's making those arguments in appropriate forums. I think the one point we shouldn't lose, and that I would hope the callers would not lose, is that there are foreign affairs authorities on both sides of the executive and the legislative balance sheet, and we have not seen great legislative exercise, great congressional oversight, notwithstanding the fact that there have been several bills suggested to address the question of terrorist surveillance, to address the question of military commissions. It is my hope that notwithstanding the fact that we're facing a midterm election, that Congress will step up to the plate and deal with those issues because, quite frankly, we depend upon them to be the most specific and direct check upon excessive exercises of power by the executive branch. And it is far preferable to have Congress act than it is to have the court.
Well, very interesting. Certainly agreement here, Lawrence Tribe and Douglas Kamiak. The president may be pushing things, but it's the non-action of Congress that may ultimately be more important and more decisive here. Quickly, Professor Kamiak, and I'll say goodbye to you. Are we on the edge of the abyss, close to the abyss, or far from the abyss?
Well, I don't think we're in the abyss. I don't think we're on its edge, but I think we need to be ever vigilant for our rights. The fact of the matter is that we have authorities in the Supreme Court that do give the president great authority in times of war. What we want to know is whether we are in a time of war still, to what degree those authorities, if we're not still in wartime, need to be modified so that they're being operated within the rule of law. And I'm confident that as the arguments are made on appeal, for example, with the terrorist surveillance case, that the appeals court will be responding to legal arguments made within the structure of the Constitution. And therefore, John, we're not close to the abyss or its precipice, because we still have a president and a court system that are observing the constitutional rules of the game, and that's what's most important.
Professor Douglas Kamiak, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you both.
Professor of Constitutional Law at Pepperdine University, a hopeful response there. Let's go to Dan from Kent, Connecticut. You're on the air, Dan.
Thanks for taking my call. I guess this sort of picks up with where Professor Kamiak just left off. Am I being unrealistically optimistic, as a liberal Democrat, by the way, when I say that I don't feel threatened by anything that the president is doing, as long as we still have Congress and the Supreme Court, I feel much more threatened by what terrorists and other threatening elements around the world have been up to. With the system of checks and balances that we have, bearing in mind a comment was made earlier that we have spineless partisans in Congress, well, maybe we have some of those, but we also have principled people who really support the Constitution and the president. We also have an independent judiciary, so why should I feel more threatened by these constitutional issues, if there are any, than I should by, for example, Al-Qaeda?
Dan, let me just ask you one question. I mean, is that how you evaluate what's going on in the government? You wake up and you go, what's worse, the president winning this wiretap case or me being blown up in a terrorist incident? It seems like you're always going to be fearful of the bombing in that case.
Well, I guess what I try to do is to evaluate each new move by the executive branch or any other branch in light of what's in the Constitution, in light of constitutional precedent, and the fact that I know the Constitution is a living document which has to roll with the punches of the times, including, I would say, an ever-changing definition of what war is.
All right, Dan, thank you very much for joining us. Larry Tribe, take that point, and also what Douglas Kamiak was saying at the end there. Are we in a state of war or not? Who determines that, and is that something that ever would go before the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court said that, for the sake of argument, both in the Hamdi case about a year ago and in the Hamdan case, both dealing with Guantanamo, it would be prepared to assume that we're in a state of war. But war is not the equivalent of a blank check for presidential power. That's ultimately what's most important. It's also important to ask the question, what kind of war is it? Is it a war without end? Is it a war that might end in some kind of armistice? Or is it a war that, by definition, might go on indefinitely, so that any power claimed in the name of this war is a power that we have to be particularly vigilant to control? I think it's the latter kind of war, and there is no authoritative final word on it within our system. It's simply one of the elements of the conversation. But let me say a word about Dan's comparison of the various threats. Certainly it's worse to be blown up than it is to have someone eavesdrop on your conversations. Most of us, I think, are going to suffer neither fate. We will not ourselves be the subject of eavesdropping, and we're not going to be blown up. But I think it is more likely that we will gradually get accustomed to a world in which we assume that Big Brother may be listening to our conversations than it is that we will change our behavior because there might be another 9/11. Nations like Ireland and Israel have grown accustomed to a terrifying degree of terrorism and gone about their ordinary business. One way you defeat terrorists is by not allowing yourself to act in such a way that your freedoms have all been given away anyway. But a nation that is prepared to look the other way when eavesdropping on a wholesale basis is justified by the minuscule possibility that a suspicious conversation will be turned up, a nation that gives away its birthright in the illusory quest of total safety and security has already lost a great deal. It seems to me that the proof that engaging in this kind of warrantless eavesdropping without going back to Congress and getting a modern system of some kind of meaningful oversight, that proof is sadly absent. And the Congress that we now have, though it's a check of sorts, is considering legislation that would be essentially a whitewash of what the president is doing. And I think that it's important that Congress do more than whitewash it.
So as a rule of thumb for our caller, Dan, in theory anyway, allowing encroachment and growth of executive power may change your life in the long term, but allowing fear of terrorism to intervene maybe changes your mind and your mood in the short term, and perhaps it's the long term where people should keep their eyes on the ball. From New Bedford, Massachusetts, Paul is on the air.
Yes, I'm a 23-year veteran in the military. I'm disabled right now. I hope you can understand me because I had a stroke 2 years ago.
We're hearing you loud and clear, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, I was kind of curious if it would be practical to print up the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights in like a trifold card where every citizen can keep in his wallet, and that way they can be more aware of the Constitution. Like, I'm sorry to say that I'm really not familiar with the Constitution, and I don't even know where I can have access to it.
Well,
I don't know if it would cause a healthy debate in this country or whether the regular layperson would not understand the documents good enough to, you know, understand them, and it would cause more confusion.
No, it's a great point, Paul. Certainly the strength of our democracy depends on the shared understanding of these founding documents. Do you think there's a problem there?
Well, I think Paul makes a very good point. The people who were very influential in interpreting the Constitution early in our history made the point that it is not supposed to be a technical legal document written only for lawyers and experts to understand. It's important that the document itself and opinions about its meaning be understandable, and to be understandable, they have to be accessible. Paul can go to a local library. If he has access to the internet, he can just Google the Constitution. It's not hard to find the words. The trouble is the words themselves, for the most part, don't tell you an awful lot. Sometimes they're clear. The president has to be 35 years old. That doesn't mean he must be mature. If it meant something that vague, a lot of our presidents would never have made it. But when it says something like the government may not engage in an unreasonable search and seizure, you know, whether it's reasonable or unreasonable to have electronic eavesdropping of all conversations between you and someone overseas that the executive says might have some connection with terrorism, that's not a question that you can find the answer to in any little pamphlet.
Raises an interesting point. Now, if the president is over 35, can he be impeached?
Well, certainly not on grounds of age,
I
but
see.
On grounds of abuse of power.
So it's at least 35. I see.
This president, I think, has done a few things that people might regard as impeachable.
Well, I think Steve is perhaps not one of those people. He's from Orlando, Florida. Steve, you're on the air.
Thank you. No, I think the president is right on target. I think he's well within his wartime rights. I think my concern is more with the what appears to be a fear of the Republican Party keeping its power, and rather than what the terrorists are trying to do. And so I support the president.
But do you think that fighting terrorism depends on maintaining a Republican government?
Yes.
I see. So the terrorists are Democrats?
No, I think the terrorists will be emboldened by takeover by the Democrats who have been fighting, it seems like, every attempt by the president to do what he is charged to do, which is primarily to protect the citizens.
All right, Steve, thank you very much. You know, part of this debate over separation of powers is also a debate over an approach to the war on terror. That's a political debate. We're having a constitutional discussion, but I wonder how the political differences in government right now bear on this separation of powers issue.
Well, it seems to me that, with all respect to Steve, the issue transcends politics. There are a lot of very good Republicans, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a Republican with a military background, John McCain of Arizona, a Republican who was tortured rather than give up his beliefs in this country, wouldn't agree with Steve that somehow the Democratic Party and its criticisms of some of what the president does is to somehow be equated with the terrorists. I think the moment as a country we get at one another's throats and stop giving credence to the good faith and patriotism of our adversaries, we really might as well throw in the towel. I think the kind of position that Steve is taking is one that I hope he would reconsider.
Sam from Wellfleet, Mass., you're on the air, Sam.
Hey, Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I think we're already in the abyss. When I compare what happened in Vietnam to what happened in Iraq, in Vietnam, that was done all in secrecy. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin was made up. We didn't find that until years later. But the war in Iraq was all done in broad daylight. Millions and millions of people around the world knew that it was all trumped up. What's frightening to me is that this could happen, and all the talk about law wasn't enough to stop a president and an executive from deceiving the American people and the world. And, you know, it wasn't always a war. I remember when it was first going to be a crusade, and they tried that word for a couple of days. That didn't fly. Then they changed it to a war. But to many, many people, it was very, very clear that Iraq was never a threat, that all the things were, the connections were bogus. We had inspectors in there. There was no need. There was no threat. And, you know, Saddam was our tyrant. And I think that it was genius of this Republican administration to pick something like terrorism, a term that no one can define. And
I think Democrats might have stumbled on terrorism as the justification for policy had they been in power. I mean,
Reagan stumbled upon it. He's the one who first thought of the using terrorism way back around the time of Iran-Contra.
Well, wars and international crises are opportunities for presidents of all parties. I guess the question really is, since the Congress voted for this war and the president, you know, under whatever justification, went to war with Iraq, is the constitutional question of the legitimacy of the war, which Sam raises eloquently, is it even a constitutional question? Is it moot?
Well, first of all, I think, although I probably am coming from the same place that Sam is politically, I think there's a certain amount of revisionist history in saying that we all knew from the very beginning that there was no threat here. The fact is that a lot of people on the Democratic as well as the Republican side, including Clinton, believed that there were weapons of mass destruction. And if anyone is to be charged with having been deceptive and having known better, it's probably the administration and not all of those who went along with it.
There's not a constitutional fraud case, is there?
I don't think so. I think that there ultimately in the ideal world, deliberately or even recklessly deceiving the nation into going to war would be an impeachable offense. Mm-hmm. But I think it is not a constitutionally litigable offense. I don't think there's any chance that someone would say that this war is unconstitutional in some way that a court could ever take cognizance of. But I think...
And for a whole variety of reasons, the impeachment question is sort of off the table for a lot of very interesting reasons that would constitute a whole other radio show.
Right. I mean, literally political reasons. Democrats are afraid to use the big I word because people will say, oh, that's why they want to get in power. Mm. They want to distract the country with impeachment.
Congressional oversight, presidential power. Lawrence Tribe, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm John Hockenberry, in for Tom Ashbrook. This, of course, is On Point.